I put a spell on you because you're mine. You better stop the things you're doing. I ain't lying, no, I ain't lying. Yeah, you better quit it, Daddy. You better quit your running around. And if you don't do it, Daddy, I'm gonna have to put you down. I put a spell on you because you're mine.
Great. I'm Joe Blumenthal, and this is the next in the NCMC podcast series. And today we're going to be talking to Evelyn Harris, who leads one of the choruses here at the Northampton Community Music Center. And I have to confess, as an interviewer, I've never had a spell put on me before, but that was great. I loved it. Thank you. So let's just start off, if you could just tell me a little bit about your background, who your people are, where you're from.
Take it away. I was born in 1950 on the Fort Lee Army Base. My father was in Korea when I was born in 1950. And raised in Richmond, Virginia, basically by my grandparents. I went to Howard University in 1968 and immediately fell under the spell of the student rights movement. So I didn't even have any classes until my sophomore year because we had taken over the campus. And we got everything that we asked for, which was a gospel choir to be accredited and for jazz to be a part of the music department. And that was in 1969. I spent a lot of time in D.C. Singing in jazz clubs mostly until I saw an ad in the fine arts elevator that a group called Sweet Honey in the Rock was having auditions up Georgia Avenue at the D.C. Black Repertory Company. And at that time, D.C. Black Rep was helmed by Robert Hooks and Motochiko Winfield. At the time, that was Lynn Whitfield's husband. And you may recognize that name. She's one of the main characters in the TV show Greenleaf, as we speak.
Okay. Could we back up just a little bit? And did you start singing as a young girl?
I started singing at five years old. Uh-huh. So the Cherubim Choir was the children's choir. Uh-huh. And you had to be 7 years old to be in it, but I got in at five. Uh-huh. And I spent most of those growing up years singing in church. Uh-huh. Lots of people in my family would have me sing for their friends or club meetings or weddings and funerals, all kinds of things as I was growing up. And I always knew I wanted to be a singer, but there were no Black women in Richmond who had a career that I could look up to or be informed by. So I went to Howard to major in music and theater.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you saw the audition for Sweet Honey and the Rock. And
yeah, so, 1974 that was.
Okay, remind us where the name of that group comes
from. It's a parable in the Bible that refers to a land that is so rich that honey flows from the rocks.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah. Sweet Honey and the Rock was not kind of an ordinary entertaining group, as I understand it. Can you tell me a little bit
about... Well, it was more like a singing newspaper. Uh-huh. We were a cappella, at least most times five singers, and a sign language interpreter. Uh-huh. We were told by the deaf community that they could feel the music. And as our bodies moved, they would move with us. So we made that an integral part of our concerts. And we did lots of spirituals. music from Africa, work songs, and Bernice Johnson Regan was the artistic director, and she was at the time teaching at Howard University in the African American Studies department. And she was doing the vocal workshops at the Black Theater Company. And some of the people in the original workshops said to her, why don't we start singing this music outside of the theater? And that's how the group got started. It was actually the first rehearsal, I'm told, was four men and four women. And they did well. The second rehearsal, only women showed up. And they decided then that that was going to be Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Right.
Yeah.
When you sing, I often see you using a percussion of some kind. Did you do that in Sweet Honey in the Rock also?
Yeah, okay. Hand percussion.
Right.
Yeah.
Would you say, and did Sweet Honey in the Rock have kind of a mission that, or maybe you could elaborate on the singing newspaper idea a little bit, like you wanted, something you wanted to do that was more than just entertain people?
Yeah, and entertainment is not what Sweet Honey was about. We always wanted people to like us and like the sound, but entertaining was not the goal. Information was the goal. And the information came from a Black woman's perspective in the U.S. And so a lot of our songs were political in nature and in lyrics. And we borrowed from all the forms that Black people, musical forms that Black people had created in this country. So we did jazz-like, we did spiritual-like, we did blues-like. And it made for a varied repertoire. Everybody had to write. Everybody had to lead.
Everybody had to
compose. Everybody was tasked with composing, with leading, as well as background.
You had you toured all over the U.S. I assume
the world,
all over the world.
Yeah.
Was there any one performance or one time or some memory of a particular thing that really stood out that was really exciting? Or
whenever I'm asked that question, I always talk about Veradero Beach in Cuba. gosh, I wish I could remember the year, but we weren't supposed to go there. It was before we were country was allowing people to travel straight there, so I think we went through Mexico City. But it was a festival there, and it was just beautiful country. And I love the old cars and the cobbled streets, and the food was divine. There were lots of places that made us feel comfortable and throughout the red carpet, quote unquote, for us. Going to Carnegie Hall the first time was a big deal. And it became a yearly thing that we did for many years.
Did you ever, and you were touring probably later than other people would have experienced this, but did you ever have really uncomfortable experiences, particularly in the South? You know, I've seen the movie Green Book, for example, and it occurred to me that you might have had to live through some of that stuff.
I don't remember that. We were always comforted by the people that surrounded us from the time we got picked up at the airport, dropped off at the hotel, things like that. I don't remember any uncomfortable situations. Okay. I'm sure, you know, there probably were. But
10 years earlier, there would have been.
Yeah, 10 years, or yeah, just 10 years earlier, there would have been. And in particular, our audiences were always mostly white wherever we went. Because we weren't played on the radio. We weren't a top 40 group, so lots of Black people didn't know who we were until they walked into the hall.
Did you feel like it was part of your mission to like communicate this specifically to white people?
No, not specifically. You know, once the music is out there, it's for everyone. It's for everyone's ears and minds and hearts to feel and to think about. I'm sure we may have made a difference in some of those people's minds and hearts, and that's a good thing too. But it was just wonderful most of the time. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about the chorus that you lead at the Community Music Center. I've seen you perform, but I'm not. Why don't you pronounce it? Because I'm
Kuumba.
Kuumba.
Yeah. So it's KU UMBA.
Okay. So how long have you been doing that?
Well, Jason and I have been trying to figure this out for a few years. I think since 2004.
Wow. Yeah. That's a long time.
Yeah, it is.
So what were your thoughts when you started the, you know, what was your mission of the Kuumba Choir when you got started with it?
Well, when I first started, Justina had just retired from calling that A Little Lunch Music. That was the title of that chorus. And it met in the middle of the day on Tuesdays. So that limited and opened up, you know, the people that would be able to come. And I started off with all spirituals and teaching a cappella. I would sing the part and they would sing it back to me. Uh-huh. It took me about 5 or 6 years before I started using some sheet music, because a lot of times the women didn't read and they were intimidated.
So it is an all women's group.
It is an all women's group, yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. And always has been.
Right.
Yeah.
So you probably did you borrow Sweet Honey repertoire?
Oh, yes, yeah, yes, when I could, absolutely, yeah.
You do harmonies, you teach harmonies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which voice were you in?
Well, you had to do everything. You had to use your whole range, yeah, yeah. So I was always usually in the middle or lower than the middle. Uh-huh. But since I've been here and trained by the master, Jane Hansen, I'm a soprano, and I never knew that.
Okay.
But it is easier for me to sing high in my high register now that I've been trained by her.
Uh-huh. Well, I assume all the singers in the this group are probably white, or
most times, yeah. We've had a few people of color to come in.
You have,
yeah. It's a community choir,
uh-huh.
So that I don't do auditions.
Right.
Anybody who walks through the door is in, and I try to exploit positively their gifts.
Uh-huh. Is it hard getting white people to sing black music, or is it? And how is that an issue, or is it?
It's always an issue.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's hard, but sometimes you can't teach an old dog new tricks, and I use the word old just because of that phrase, not because my population is elderly. we work on it. We work on it hard, and it has tried my patience and frustrated me in a lot of ways, but I've learned from them because of the passion that they have for the music.
Uh-huh.
And that calms me down and hopefully makes me a better teacher.
When you perform, I think you sometimes sing with them, or do you not sing
sometimes
with them?
Sometimes I sing with them, yeah.
Do you ever think about that? Like, sometimes I should sing, sometimes I shouldn't sing.
No.
When I've heard you, I always notice when you sing, because it kind of lifts things up.
And so that's why I do it, to lift things up, to lift them up, and to lift myself up and lift the music. Uh-huh. Yeah, there are lots of times that I always hear another part, so I will add that. And sometimes in rehearsal and sometimes not. But I've learned that I have to add it in rehearsal, or it'll freak out the singers if I come up with something that they haven't heard before.
Right. Yep, I can see that. I always felt, you know, if you're an aspiring musician, the best thing you can do is start doing music with somebody who's much better than you are, and it lifts you up.
That's right, yeah.
So you have a... a new group. It's not that. I guess you started before the pandemic, the Stompbox Trio.
Trio started in 17.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about what that's about?
It's my blues band. Uh-huh. And in January 2017, we lost a person in our community that was irreplaceable, and that was Art Steele. In the spring of that year, Susan Lisk, who runs the Porter Phelps Museum in Hadley, asked me to do a tribute concert to Art Steele and his music. Uh-huh. And Art Steele was a blues man.
Now he was a sound man for Sweet Honey also. Was that for
Since
a long time?
Since 79.
Right? Yeah.
Yes. And he would always do sound for me around this area when he was in town.
Did he have anything to do with getting you up here?
No, he didn't. No, I landed here. I didn't know where I was going. I landed here.
Because he's been in the valley for
many years. Yeah. So Susan Lisk asked me to do a tribute concert out at Porter Phelps in June. And the guitar player that I hired was John Caban.
Right.
And so after that, I had such a great time doing blues like that. I'd never done blues before. And so I asked him if he'd like to do something together. And David Rodriguez had just returned from Japan, and he was an upright bass player, and he was looking for work. So the three of us got together and made some great music. So we hooked up the group, and John is in charge, and he's like our booking agent, and he knows everybody, and he got us gigs all over the area.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So have you started singing with them again now that the pandemic is in retreat?
Yes.
It feels good, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does. We worked all through July.
Uh-huh.
And we have other things coming up. We'll be at Trans Performance in a couple of weeks.
Right. That's always fun.
Doing John Lee Hooker.
Oh, cool.
And so glad to be working again.
Yeah. Well, it was a long, lonely time.
It was.
When you think about songs that you might like to sing, what do you look for in a song that makes it something that you would want to sing?
The poetry has to mean something to me. I have to feel the lyrics. I have to let the music move me. And the most recent example of that is a song by a country singer, a black woman singing country, named Mickey Guyton. She has a song called Black Like Me. And when I heard it, I had to sing it. I was supposed to sing it out at
Stump Sprouts.
Yeah.
But
our concert got canceled because of rain.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm just aching to sing that song.
Do you ever sing Strange Fruit?
I've never sung Strange Fruit publicly. No.
It's I recently saw that documentary about U.S. versus Billie Holiday.
Yes.
One of the lines in that was, you know, your grandchildren are going to be singing that song, and long after everybody's forgotten about you. But it's
yes, it is still being sung.
Yeah, I could imagine you singing that song. But, you've sung with a lot of different people, particularly piano players. What do you look for when you think about who you want to have accompany you?
I look for Miro Sprague.
He's not around here anymore, is he?
I know. Oh boy, and Miro is just a beast of a piano player, and he is the quintessential accompanist. I never got lost with him. But when I did, he was always right there. He knew how to get me back. I've also used Jerry Noble. But he's not at Smith anymore, so I don't know what I would do next. I really don't. I work with Kevin Sharp, Avery Sharp's brother, who lives in Springfield, and I work with him on piano. Okay. And he was going to accompany me at Stump Sprouts.
Do you have any interesting stories about something bizarre or funny that happened when you were on the road? Most musicians see crazy things because they play so many different places and so many different people. Do you have any interesting stories you'd like to share?
You know, I don't have a good memory. At 71, I'm not holding memories like I used to. Uh-huh. So no, I can't think of anything right off the bat.
Uh-huh. Or maybe a time when you felt that your performance really made a difference to somebody, like just really got through to them, or really connected, or really...
That happens all the time. Uh-huh. When people are bold enough to come up to me and tell me that, I hear it a lot. And those people don't have names, but they do have places in my heart. Uh-huh. And that's how I know I'm still doing the right thing.
Okay. So this interview is a little bit shorter than they usually are, but I've run through all the questions I had for you. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, thank you for asking.
And would you like to, or if you don't want to do this, we'll pick something else, but would you like to sing a little bit of that Black Like Me to go out?
Let's see. Little girl in a small town, I did my best just to fit in. Broke my heart on the playground when they said I was different. Now I'm all grown up and nothing has changed. Yeah, it's still the same. It's a hard life on Easy Street. Just white painted picket fence as far as you can see. And if you think we live in the land of the free, you should try to be, black like me. That's all I remember.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Joe, for asking.